Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and around the world in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the sting stories when we come back. And let me ask you this. What do you think is wrong with the Ten Commandments? Because it's pretty obvious that something is wrong with the Ten Commandments because they've been banned from our public schools, they're banned from our public institutions, and they've been banned from our national consciousness. Now, instead of these ten simple, time-tested laws, we see the ten planks to the Communist Manifesto in their place, and we're teaching the ten planks to the Communist Manifesto to our children in public school, in our public institutions. We've made them a part of our national psyche. You know, this is a pretty radical change in our political and moral outlook over the past 50 years. Are you aware, for instance, that your daughter couldn't receive an aspirin in your public school without your consent, but she can have an abortion arranged through that same public school nurse without even your knowledge, much less your consent? That's why I contend that the solution to this kind of moral perversion and national insanity is to go back to what worked. Let's go back to the Ten Commandments and the Ten Commandment model, the Mosaic Law. You know, our founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention in 1787 practiced and advocated the Ten Commandments. They even put 22 principles of that law into our federal constitution. Now, there's at least one school left in America that still teaches this entire Mosaic Law, the Ten Commandments, and all 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments, as well as the penalties and the benefits for their observance. Now, every law has a penalty. You don't have to know what the penalty is to suffer from its effects. So whether we call this the Mosaic Law, the law of God, the common law, natural law, karma, or something else, it's automatic. Works just like AIDS, herpes, and VD, which just happened to be the natural penalty for adultery. Now, if you'd like more information, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package first? That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. And remember, it's educational, and it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, doesn't cost you anything. It's free. So you can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Click on to the email. Send us an email request. Or, better yet, why don't you click on to our archives page and you can download that free general law CD package right there. That's georgegordon.org on our archives page. All right, we're talking about sting stories over here, and sometimes people will accuse me of being a tax protester. I'm a cult leader. I get accused of that quite often. I deny that. I'm not running any cult. Then I'm sometimes accused of being a tax protester or an anarchist. I deny that. I'm not a tax protester. I'm not an anarchist. I'm not advocating that we abolish law or that we refuse to pay taxes. The upshot of this is that I pay tax. I think that some people would get upset with the guy I'm paying the tax to. Now, the creator of the universe requires that we pay taxes. It's called a tithe. T-I-T-H-E, tithe, three of them. And you people out there think you're paying taxes. You wait until you get hold of my tax obligations. Now, I'm not complaining. No, I don't want you to get the wrong impression here, but the idea that I don't pay taxes is preposterous poppycock. I think the United States of America is bummed out because I'm not paying taxes to the United States of America, or I'm not paying taxes to the state of Missouri, or I'm not paying taxes, you know, to this or that group, organization, or trust, or foundation, or somebody else, but I'm paying taxes. Don't think otherwise. Now, years ago, before I understood this tax problem or this tax program, I used to pay taxes to the United States of America, income tax, Social Security tax, workman's compensation tax, and God, unemployment tax, and state income tax, and state this and that tax, and so on. And then I got into, well, I wonder what causes this, and how does this work, and why does it work that way? How did I get involved with this? And I didn't know. God, I was just dumb as a box of rocks. And there was a guy by the name of Nealis Cook, and he was a student of a fellow named Bill Avery. Now, Bill Avery was a lawyer, just an everyday garden variety lawyer. He worked for Standard Oil Company of California back in 1939. This is back during the New Deal era. You know, this is Franklin Roosevelt's period of time. And Bill Avery asked himself the question, being trained in law, where in the hell does the President of the United States and the Congress get the power to impose these patently unconstitutional laws and programs on the American people? You know, like Social Security and workman's comp and the CCC and all these bureaucratic socialist and communist programs. And he was just asking the question, where in the hell do they get this power? And at the time, he said, these unconstitutional laws. Well, now, these laws are not unconstitutional. They're contractual. So they're not constitutional and they're not unconstitutional, they're contractual. And Article 1, Section 10 prohibits government from interfering with your right to contract. Now let's understand a very vital principle here. A free man, think of yourself as being a free man, must have the capacity to enslave himself. Else, he's not free. If I could prevent you from enslaving yourself, you would not be free to make that decision for yourself. That's why you have the capacity to check yourself into a mental hospital. You can't check yourself out, but you can check yourself in. You have the capacity to join the army. You do not have the capacity to unjoin. It's like a Venus flytrap. You can go in, but you can't come out. Now that's what freedom's all about. Freedom means that you have the capacity to do something. And, you know, primarily whatever you want. And anytime you can be restricted, like the Ten Commandments, if you think the Ten Commandments give you a license to freedom, you got your head up the wrong end. All law restricts your freedom. Now that's why God told you that this law, in Deuteronomy 4, verse 2, and Deuteronomy 12, 32, he said, don't add to this, and don't take anything away from it. You practice this law. In the Bible, it's called the perfect law of liberty. So if you want liberty, you practice the Ten Commandment model. Now, that does not mean that the Ten Commandment model is a license to just do as you damn well please. Well, for instance, there's a law in here that says thou shalt not commit adultery. Now, truth be known, I really want to sleep with your wife. That's right. Now, the only reason that I'm not exercising that liberty is because there's a law that says thou shalt not commit adultery. That's a law that protects your property right in your wife, or your husband, as the case may be. And so that's a restriction on my liberty. So a restriction on something that I want to do. So don't think for a minute now that the Ten Commandment model is anarchical or that you can just do as you please, because you can't. But it's limited in its scope. Instead of coming up with 2,000 traffic laws, God has an entire traffic code in the Bible, believe it or not. You can operate the entire traffic system of Missouri based upon those 759 laws of the Bible. Works perfectly. No problems. You don't need a seatbelt law and a compulsory insurance law in order to have financial responsibility or safety. It's built right into the Ten Commandment model. Let me show you. You got a law here that says buckle your seatbelt, and if you don't, we're going to fine you $300 and throw you in jail for 90 days. That restricts your liberty. It takes away from you the responsibility of deciding for yourself, do I or do I not buckle my seatbelt on this trip? God, the author of liberty, says to you, hey, look, partner, if you want liberty, you can have it. The seatbelt's there, and you can decide whether you want to buckle it or not. It's your choice. But we're not going to punish you if you make the wrong choice and don't buckle your seatbelt, get involved in an auto accident, go through the windshield, break your neck, and kill you dead on a popcorn fart. We are not going to put you in jail for 90 days. We're not going to fine you $300. Now, the state does that. They restrict your liberty. God doesn't. He gives you full choice, free choice. Now, in the realm of taxation, God gives us free choice. You do not have to pay your tithes. And if you don't, he is not going to put you in jail, but he's not going to give you your benefits. This is a reciprocal or a reciprocity type program. And he tells you that very plainly in Malachi 3:8. He says, hey, I gave you a law, so pay me my tithe. If you pay me my tithe, I will pour you out a blessing that there won't be room to receive it. If you don't pay me my tithe, I will not pour you out a blessing. That's how simple this process is. This is why the income tax is voluntary. You cannot compel people to pay tithe. You cannot compel people to pay income tax. Now, government lacking the capacity to force you to pay this income tax, they got to do something kind of tricky. Now, in the last program, I showed you, if you want to sign that that final decree, then you're signing up and agreeing to pay the child support. I didn't do that. I wanted to terminate that contract. So, when we talk about income tax, you either have to have a constitutional amendment or you got to have a contract. And so, the powers that be elected for the contract. The contract is contained in the Social Security Act, cited at Title 42, Section 301 through 335. There's where your connecting link is. Once you sign up for Social Security, you owe the income tax, and that's your taxpayer identification number. Congress told you that in 1964. And furthermore, you can't file a tax return without a TIN, a taxpayer identification number, or Social Security number. If you think you can, go try it. Go test it. I did. Now, this guy, Bill Avery, wanted to know the answers to some of these questions. Where does this power come from? It comes from admiralty. It comes from contract. So, there was a story that came out of the Idaho judicial process that I was involved in as the GOAT. Now, I took a job at the Circle K Company while I was teaching school here at the Mardi Gras, and I took a job at working weekends at Circle K so that I could test some legal issues. I needed to be working for a corporation so that I'd have an opportunity to test Social Security, income tax, you know, the various and sundry statutes and duties and obligations and admiralty and common law and rights versus privilege and one thing and another. Now, I'm here to tell you the Circle K company, they were not at all happy with me and my testing of legal issues. They just didn't like that at all. And they fired me. I mean, they just said, we've had enough of you. And I've only been fired twice in my life. And once was Reynolds and Petrol, and the other one was Circle K. So I'm probably never get a job working in a convenience store for the rest of my life, but I've got to report it to you anyway. So you can learn a lesson from this. There's a sting that comes into play here. Now, I had always filed my tax returns and paid all my taxes. So in case any of you tax collectors out there are sitting there chomping at the bit and salivating and saying this guy's a dirty low-down tax cheat, that's false. I never cheated the government out of a nickel's worth of tax. Never. Didn't then. And not now, and don't tend to in the future. So I didn't file a tax return, a state tax return, for the earned income at the Circle K company. Now, I got a wife and five kids. I don't owe any tax. I do owe a tax return. I don't deny it. I did owe a tax return, but I did not owe any tax. So I did not file my state tax return. Didn't file a federal one either, but then you know I was below the filing minimum on that. But I did have a tax return that I needed to file for the state, and I didn't file it. Now, they had a guy there at the Department of Revenue, State Tax Commission, I think they call it up there, and his name was Bill Von Tagen. Nice guy, I'm sure. Nothing, can't get any bad words now for Bill. But our legislature up there had passed a law called the Mandamus Act, and we thought the Mandamus Act was patently unconstitutional and that it was an ex post facto law, which compelled people to come in to Bill Von Tagen's office and spill their guts and produce all these records and books, which we thought violated our Fourth and Fifth Amendment rights. Now, as it turns out, that wasn't true. And like with OSHA, you know, I was dead wrong, and I don't mind admitting it. Bill Von Tagen was 100% right. Mandamus was constitutional. Mandamus applied to me, and by God, I needed to file my tax return. Now, I didn't do that. And so I got to tell you the story because it's a part of what we deal with here, what we call the sting stories. You know, sometimes they're stinging me, and sometimes I'm stinging them. You know, so, you know, it works both ways. Now, I wanted to find the answer to this, and Nealis Cook, who was the student of Bill Avery, came in to the school, and he said, Gordon, you are wrong. And he said, you owe the tax return because you have a Social Security number and because you volunteered. It's a contract. And I said, I don't believe it. I think you're wrong. I think Social Security is a retirement program. Doesn't have anything to do with income tax. I think you got your head up the wrong end. And so, you know, that's the way people are. You know, you get it in your head that this is the way it is, and by God, that's what I'm going to do. And you know, so some time went on, and wanting to test this, I didn't file the tax return. One day I got a letter from Mr. Von Tagen. He said, hey, you, file. And so I wrote him a letter back, and I said, not by the hair on my chinny chin chin. And then so he sent me this mandamus, and I said, ex post facto law, and we ain't going to comply with that. Now, I'm not arguing over income tax. See, I'm not opposed to paying my fair share, you know, unlike Idaho Power Company and Ford Motors and big corporations. I'm willing to pay my fair share, but I got a wife and five kids. I don't owe you any money, number one. And number two, you can't make me file because of my Fourth and Fifth Amendment rights, and this mandamus rule that you've got over here is unconstitutional. By God, I'm going to go test it. Now, one day, I got a subpoena into court and said, okay, well, let's go tell it to the judge. Now, the judge that pulled this case, his name was Judge Schwartzman, and he was a Jewish judge, Schwartzman, and he was a Jew. And he was kind of a no-nonsense kind of guy. I've had a little judicial business with him three times. I found he was good. I got to tell you, this guy was really sharp. He was kind of like Judge Becker, you know. And when you came into the courtroom, I'm not sure that the litigants knew what the hell was going on, but you can rest assured that this judge, he knew what was happening here on both sides. And so when we came in, Von Tagen came in under the mandamus statute, and he said, this guy Gordon owes me this tax return, and he owes me this information under this law, and I want you to order him to produce. And so when it was my turn, I told the judge, no, wrong, ex post facto law, and I don't owe it to him, and blah, 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 and I presented my case. And the judge was very attentive. He was watching me, you know, paying attention. I got full attention out of the judge. And so he says, well, okay, I'll write you an opinion, and then in 21 days I'll send it to you. 3 weeks later, I got the judge's opinion. He said, Gordon, you got your head up the wrong end. You owe the report. Give it to him. Sit down and shut up. Now, I wasn't satisfied with that. I came back to Barrister's Inn, and I said, listen to what this judge has said, blah, blah, blah. Nealis Cook said, I told you. I got it from Bill Avery. Bill Avery worked this out, and he said, hey, listen, there's connecting links to Admiralty. Now, let me give you a couple ideas here, boys and girls. Listen to this. Now, remember, we in the last program, I said Volume 2, Brown 100, lays down the rule that no person can be subject to the jurisdiction of Admiralty but by his consent expressed by his entering into a stipulation. That being the case, then there had to be a stipulation. Now, there's a lot of cases that come down. I won't burden you with all these cases over here, but hey, listen, Ramsey is one. And Satterley versus Matthewson is another. Lord versus Rhyme. It goes clear back, you know, into the statutes of Queen Anne and Henry V, for crying out loud. I mean, this is a part of Anglo-Saxon administration. It goes back into the Middle Ages. Now, Bill Avery was smart enough to go research it out. Neelis Cook was smart enough to pick up on it. I'm a novice at this juncture of time. I don't know whether my hind end is bored or punched, but I'm of the opinion, having been to public school, that, you know, I've got my opinions over here. So I wrote up another answer to this. No, I'm not going to do it, and here's why. And so Judge Schwartzman, in this case, he scheduled another hearing. This started off about April or May or so, and so there's another hearing comes up about July, maybe August, something like that. And we went in and we argued this again, and I came back and I brought in more arguments as to why it is that I ought not to be subject to this and blah, blah, blah. And so the judge said, well, okay, I'll take 3 weeks and write you an opinion. He wrote me an opinion. He said, Gordon, you're wrong again. And in fact, in the courtroom, he said, you know, Mr. Gordon, you're a pretty bright guy over here, and I think that you're probably barking up the wrong tree. He wrote me the opinion, came back, and he said, here's why you're wrong. He said, number one, you're wrong, and here's why. And I took that back down to Barrister's Inn, and I said, you know, I think that this is wrong, and here's why. And Cook again came back, and he said, you know, why don't you wake up and smell the coffee? By this time, I've been rebuffed twice, and I said, okay, I'm going to do that. When I got through, I said, you know, Cook, maybe you're right. Maybe you do have some merit here. I said, okay, why don't we try this? Why don't we test it? Cook said, fine, I'll write up the brief. Now, in this second meeting, the second hearing, the judge said to me, Gordon, you know, you're a very bright, intelligent fellow. I think you're barking up the wrong tree. And he said, you know, I think that the next time we meet, if you don't comply here, the next time we meet, I fear you're going to go to jail. So he said, I think you need to produce the records and the books, and I think you need to deliver them. Now, remember, I want to raise the issue of mandamus ex post facto law, just like I'd mentioned earlier to you. Say, I want to bring up Article 1, Section 9. Now, in Judge Becker's case, he said I can't repeat that over there. He said that's a bull blank issue, and that's not going to go anywhere. And Judge Schwartzman worded a little different. He said, you know, you're a very bright, intelligent fellow, and I think that the next time we meet, you're going to go to jail, probably for contempt. So the judge wants to communicate to me that this is the wrong argument, Mr. Gordon. And thank you, Mr. Schwartzman. I picked up the vibes. Yep, the wrong argument. So when I talked to Neelis the third time, you know, and he told me, he said, you know, wake up. I said, you know, maybe I am wrong. Maybe somebody else has got a better answer than I've got. Maybe I need to go test this a little bit more. Maybe I need to do a little more legal research. Cook wrote the brief, and he came back and he said, now, Mr. Gordon is the victim of fraud here. Mr. Gordon doesn't have a Social Security number. He doesn't have a contract with the state. He doesn't have any obligation to bring in these records and books. The Fourth and Fifth Amendment to the Federal Constitution control. Mandamus doesn't apply to him because he's not a member of a regulated enterprise. Now, do you remember the story about Almeida Sanchez? Remember Mr. Sanchez, the guy from Mexico hauling marijuana at 2 o'clock in the morning? And the government came in with Biswell and Colonnade Catering, and the Supreme Court came back and they made a surprising statement. They said, a businessman who is licensed, in effect, consents to the regulations imposed upon him. But the unregulated, the unlicensed marijuana mule, the guy that's just delivering the marijuana, he's not licensed, bonded, and insured. He hasn't agreed to these regulations, and he has his constitutional rights available to him. And so you guys, you know, were searching without a warrant, and it's the fruit of the poisonous tree. He can't have his marijuana back, but you can't throw him in jail. And that's where that case ended. Well, now, we learn a lesson from that. You know, there's rules out here, policemen. And you policemen out there, you have to follow the rules. You prosecutors out there, hey, there's rules. You got to follow the rules. Judges, come on, wake up. There are rules out there. You got to follow the rules. Now, as it turns out, the judges and prosecutors and the police are following the rules when they're dealing with people that have contracts and licenses. Once in a while, though, they come across some common law free man out there, and they don't know how to deal with him. This is the guy without the citizenship, without the license, without the regulations that bind upon him, because he hasn't consented into the regulations. He hasn't consented to the admiralty jurisdiction. And they don't know how to deal with him, so they treat him just like he's a seaman on a ship, when in fact he's not. then the guy that does have the rights available to him doesn't know how to go argue it. He can't take it up to the appellate court. And so some of you people are sitting out there kind of frustrated, and you're saying, oh, I tried that, and then they wouldn't listen to me. I hear that all the time. But they wouldn't listen to me. Well, they don't know how to listen to you. They've never run across anybody like you before. You walk in there and say, these aren't my children. But you see, if you walk in there and tell them these aren't my children, but you signed the divorce contract, the final decree, well, then you've reenlisted. You didn't think you did, but you did. See? Now, Judge Schwartzman over here is very familiar with this. I brought up to him that this admiralty over here isn't going to fly, and he said, you know, next time I meet you, I think I'm going to throw you in jail. All right, so we wrote this up, and we came back a third time. This came up on November 17th, 1983. I'm in front of Judge Schwartzman now. He comes into the room. This is my motion hearing, and I'm the guy that brought this motion up. And then I'm supposed to go first. He comes into the courtroom, and he calls the hearing to order, and he looks over at Montague, and he says, now, Mr. Montague, do you have any other remedies available to you that you'd like to apply other than mandamus? And he said, no. And the judge said, well, if we apply this mandamus to Mr. Gordon, won't we be violating his Fifth Amendment right concerning his testimony against himself? And he says, no, the Supreme Court has ruled that this is constitutional and blah, blah, blah. This is the state Supreme Court ruling that this mandamus statute in the state of Idaho is constitutional in the state of Idaho. Okay. And the judge went through five indicia over here. He went through the Fifth Amendment, Fourth Amendment, and First Amendment, and equal protection, due process under the 14th Amendment, and so on. There was a fifth one over here. It kind of slips in my mind now. It was five issues that the judge raised. And Montague was totally unable to argue these. Now, the issue before the court was fraud. Remember, I came in and said, I'm the victim of fraud. The thing that saved my bacon in this case, because I had a Social Security number, even though we said I didn't, I did. And whether or not I owed this tax return was predicated upon my membership. Are you a seaman on the ship, and do you have seaman's papers? The answer was, yeah, I'm a seaman on the ship. I've got seaman's papers. And I'm not following the chief petty officer's instructions. Now, that's the reality of my position. But the judge doesn't know that, and Montague doesn't know that. Montague never read my brief, so he didn't know what the issue was. He thought mandamus was the issue. It wasn't. It was fraud. Fraud was the issue. The judge knew what the issue was, fraud. He knew that Montague hadn't read the brief, or he wouldn't be arguing mandamus. It's like the defendant pleads into a fiction of law. Montague pled into a fiction of law. He didn't know what the hell the subject matter was. So the judge, at the end of the hearing, he said, well, no, I'm not going to grant the mandamus. Mr. Gordon has rights, which is exactly what I've been telling the court from day one. I've got rights. But my rights were not predicated upon mandamus. They were predicated upon the fact that I didn't have a Social Security number, that the state had defrauded me, that the state over here was using a fiction of law that I've got a Social Security number and that I'm a seaman on the ship with seaman's papers. They've got in rem jurisdiction over me because they've got in personam jurisdiction because I signed a contract. Without in personam, they don't have in rem jurisdiction. Bottom line, if you're not a seaman on the ship, they can't bring you before the chancellor. Now, the judge is sitting over here saying, well, I'm the chancellor, and you can't bring this guy before me because he doesn't have seaman's papers. Can't have a captain's mast without jurisdiction. So I was released. Now, here's my problem. Montague's going to figure this out. And this is November 17th. And on January the 1st starts a new year. Boy, I've got to clean up my act. I've got to rescind my Social Security account. I've got to do that right away. I did. Hey, listen, I'm going to have to start arguing my rights as a common law freeman. I can no longer practice admiralty. I can't get a job at Circle K. I can't work in employment. I know some of you are saying, well, then I can't be a common law freeman. I didn't say you could. Most of you people out there listening to me right now, as the Messiah said, the poor you have with you always. Not everyone out there can be wealthy. Not everyone out there can be free. And when you want to join the army, you know, you get to the point where you cannot take care of yourself, then you need a guardian. And if you need a guardian, then you can't be free. So I'm not suggesting now that we come out here and we free all the slaves of America. Boys and girls, it is not my duty, it is not my job, it is not my intention to free all of you slaves out there. If we freed all the slaves, who would do the work? Hey, we're at the halfway point. Let me remind you that you are listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and the law hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from a scriptural perspective. Now, that's eight schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the law hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives, and all of that can be accessed through our website. at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one by calling and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to the website georgegordon.org. Click on to the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. And the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements, these recommendations that we give, don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. We need to keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour, please go to our website, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about sting stories. And I just told you a little story here about an income tax case, state income tax, wherein I did not file my state income tax. I needed to if I had a Social Security number, but I didn't need to if I didn't have a Social Security number. Now, in those days, you could work without a Social Security number, and your Social Security tax was paid into what they called the suspense fund. You can still do that, but you cannot compel an employer to hire you without a Social Security number. The U.S. Supreme Court's ruled on that 3 times since we were doing this back in the 80s. That does not mean you have to work for corporations. You can work for yourself. You can work, and you could work for a corporation, and if they wanted to, they could hire you and pay the Social Security tax over to the suspense fund. They probably won't. All right, now, out of this came another neat case. There was a fellow by the name of Ben Rice. He was an attorney. Ben Rice, the lawyer from Cuna, Idaho. Ben was a very, very knowledgeable, understanding attorney. Most aren't. When you find an attorney, he has been to law school, and he's been brainwashed, and he has a perspective that is viewed strictly by the Roman civil law. Ben now had a fair to middle an understanding of the common law. And he told me, he said, it isn't good, and he didn't know as much as he'd like to, and he suggested that I go to Blackstone's commentaries and start educating myself to the common law, but he wasn't totally ignorant. And after we had done this case with Von Tagen, he had a Social Security number, he had all of the connecting links, he had a business license, a professional license, he had a marriage license, and he had children, and no other birth certificates, and he is a perfect candidate for a state slave or a slave of the state's bureaucratic system. But even though we may be members of a regulated enterprise, you may be a soldier in the Army, but that doesn't mean that you don't have rights. They may not be inalienable rights, but you have civil rights. Those are rights that are granted to you by your master. The state grants you certain rights. And among those rights are notice and opportunity to defend, certain rights to a warrant under the law, search warrants, and right to remain silent. There are a number of these rights that are called civil. Now, from God, we receive inalienable rights, unalienable rights. The right to life. The state can give you a right to life, but it's qualified. God can give you an inalienable right to life. That's called eternal life. So you've got certain rights. The Ten Commandments guarantee your rights. The Ten Commandments, in reality, is equivalent to our Bill of Rights. We got 10 elements to our Bill of Rights. We got 10 elements in the Ten Commandments. And so a law that says thou shalt not commit adultery, you say, oh, that's not a right. Well, certainly it is. It's your right to a chattel property called a wife. And then it's a prohibition against me messing with your right, your property. Or vice versa, ladies, you got a property right in your husband. So that being the case, then Ben took a look and he said, well, wait a minute, just by operation of law. Now, this is before 1986. Looking at Article 1, Section 10 of our Constitution, which up until 1986, you see, we were traders at law on a cash basis without recourse to standard dollars lawful money. After 1986, we're traders at law on a cash basis, but we have recourse to standard dollars lawful money. So before 1986, this is about 1983 or 84, Ben said, well, gee, I want to test this income tax as it relates to Article 1, Section 10, and I'm a lawyer. How am I going to do that? So he set up a sting. A sting. This is a test. Let's see if we can bait the IRS into arresting me or charging me with tax evasion so that we can create an issue. Let's see if we can get the bus driver to call a policeman to arrest the black lady who's riding the front of the bus. We've got to have a damage. Remember Morton Grove, Illinois? The lawyer went out and sued. He didn't have standing. So Ben said, well, I've got to have standing if I want to argue this, so let me go create standing. Now, it happened that a lady wrote him a check for $10,000. He took the check down to the Bank of CUNA, and he put it on the counter, and he said, I want you to give me 10,000 Morgan silver dollars. And the bank teller said, why, sir, we don't have 10,000 Morgan silver dollars in here. And he said, well, wait a minute. Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution says no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt. So when I want to go pay my debts, I need silver dollars. Can't get gold. I don't have gold. It's not available to me. But he said, now, if you don't have silver dollars in here, what do you have? And she said, well, we have Susan B. Anthony dollars. We can give you Eisenhower clad dollars. We can give you paper dollars. We can give you a money order. We can give you a cashier's check. We can give you Federal Reserve notes. We got all these thingies we can give you, but we don't have any silver dollars. Well, Title 31 of the code and Title 12, our banking codes and regulations, set down that gold and silver coin under our Constitution is the only lawful money. Now, that doesn't mean that that's the only money. It just says it's the only lawful money for the payment of taxes and legal tender. So, you know, we went into court and said, hey, wait a minute, we don't have any silver dollars with which to pay these fines, and you can't enforce upon us, you can't punish us for not doing which is impossible. That's why Congress back in 1986 came up after our work up in Idaho with barristers in, you know, the federal government was coming up against a problem. Hey, these people aren't going to pay their property taxes and not going to pay their fines. We've got to do something. So they were forced into putting in the Tax Reform Act our gold and silver back into circulation. And then in 1987, just the next year, they created that stock market collapse, and then they came up with the plunge protection team so that they could control the price of gold and silver. Now, it's another story for another day, but Ben now is a lawyer, has all of the bells and whistles. I mean, Social Security, marriage license, business license, professional license. Hey, wait a minute. The Constitution says no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt. So he says, well, then write that up and give me a piece of paper here that says you don't have any Morgan silver dollars. I might need that for evidence in court later. What is it that you propose to give me? He says, well, we could give you 10,000 $1 bills. He said, give them to me. They had to order them in, but he got 10,000 $1 bills. Now, remember, he contracted. Article 1, Section 10 prohibits government from impairing the obligation of your contracts. He contracted for $10,000. He goes to the bank with this check, which is not money. It's a chosen action. It's a claim upon money. And he says, well, give me the money. And she says, no, we can't give you the money. We don't have it. But we can give you another chosen action for this. We're going to trade your check, chosen action, for Federal Reserve note, chosen action. And he says, well, now, where am I going to get my silver dollars? She says, I don't know. We don't have. So he takes the $10,000 $1 bills. Looks in the yellow pages, and he finds Joe, the gold broker. He says, aha, I know what I'll do. So he goes over to Joe, the gold broker, and he has an attaché case with 10,000 $1 bills, and he puts it on the counter, and he says, Joe, I want you to give me 10,000 Morgan silver dollars for these 10,000 $1 bills, one for one, which is what Title 31 and Title 12 say I'm entitled to. Now, Joe, the gold broker over here, says, no, not by the hair on my chinny chin chin will you get dollar for dollar, but I will take your 10,000 chose as an action, which is a claim upon dollars, and I will give you 1,000 silver dollars, 1,000 Morgan silver dollars for 10,000 of these Federal Reserve note choses in action. And Ben says to himself, now how can this be? I contracted with this lady for $10,000. I went to the bank to cash her check, and they say, well, we can't give you silver dollars. We can't give you lawful money here, but we can give you choses in action. I take the choses in action into the gold broker, and he says that he's not going to take these choses in action for the face amount. He's going to give me 1/10, 10 to 1. He says, okay, but write it up and document it because I might have to go to litigation. So Joe, the gold broker, says, okay, in receipt of $10,000 $1 bills, I'm going to give you 1,000 Morgan silver dollars. Ben takes his 1,000 Morgan silver dollars home, puts them in a pile, and he says, okay, I contracted for 10,000, got paid 1,000. Somewhere along the line, I lost $9,000. It looks like a receivable that's uncollectible. He keeps doing that. And every month, he takes $10,000 worth of checks. He goes down to the bank. They won't cash him. Gives him the paper. He takes the paper to the gold broker. Gold broker says, I'll give you silver dollars. He takes the silver dollars. The end of the year, Ben's got 12,000 Morgan silver dollars stacked up in piles all over his bedroom. He contracted for $120,000, carefully documented. He endorsed all of the checks. Then when he cashed the checks, he couldn't get lawful money of the United States. He could not fulfill Article 1, Section 10, try though he might. He could only trade one chosen action for another chosen action until he went to some private broker. He couldn't get it at the Treasury. He couldn't get it at the bank. He couldn't get it at the Federal Reserve, but he could get it from a private broker. He says, listen, I've got these chosen action, which are legal tender for all debts, public and private. I want Morgan silver dollars, which is lawful money, legal tender for all debts, public and private. And so, you see what H.J.R. 192 did to us back in 1933? Boys and girls, it was imperative that government take away your power, your capacity to pay your debts of law, so that we could reduce you then to a seaman on the ship receiving a chosen action. We had to divorce you from your right to property to impose upon you the first plank to the Communist Manifesto, the abolition of all right to property. That's the purpose behind it, and it worked like a shot. So now Ben has a dilemma. See, he's licensed, bonded, and insured. He has to file his tax returns. If he doesn't file his tax returns, he's going to be prosecuted for willful failure to file. But there's a legal question. Did he get paid $120,000 or did he get paid $12,000? That's what we want to test. That's where we want to go. Now, in order for us to do this, we have to file a tax return. You got to file two. You got to file one with Bill Vontagen's office here at the state level, and you got to file one with Mary Trudeau up in room 235, remember, up in the federal building. She's the IRS agent here in charge. So he does. He files his tax returns. He fills them out, goes down to his account, and says, okay, now here's where we're at. I contracted with these customers out here for $120,000. But when I took their checks in, I could not cash the checks for lawful money of the United States under Article 1, Section 10, which is guaranteed me as a right. And I had to exchange them, cash them. I had to receive, accept, take, whether I wanted to or not, choses an action on the Federal Reserve. I took the Federal Reserve choses an action down to a private broker who would, in fact, cash them, but he cashed them at a terrific discount, 90%. I'd take a 90% discount in order to cash these. Somehow or another, Congress has not fulfilled their duty to fix the exchange rates on dollars, that is, Federal Reserve notes and standard dollars lawful money, which would be silver dollars, gold dollars. So he filed his tax return. He says, okay, here's what the bottom line is, and here's my documentation. Contracted with Bessie Ball Mortal for $10,000. Did this 12 times during the year. Had $120,000 worth of contract choses in action, nominally known as income. Cashed my checks, took a discount of 90%, received $12,000. I've got $108,000 worth of receivables here, but I don't know where they are, and I don't know where in the hell I'm going to collect them. So I've got income of $12,000 for which I owe 25%. Now, the question arises, does he owe the 25% in Morgan silver dollars or does he owe the 25% in Federal Reserve note dollars? Well, on the Federal Reserve note dollar, it says this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private. Now, there's no period. That's a direct citation out of Title 12 or Title 31. This note is legal tender for all debts, public and private. No period. It used to be that it went on to say, and is redeemable for or in lawful money at any United States, at any Federal Depository or Bank or the Treasury of the United States. They stopped saying that, remember, after 1964. And after they rescinded or repealed the silver clause, the silver certificates. And so now here's Ben. He's filling out his tax return. He contracted for $120,000, got paid $12,000. He's got to pay a 25% tax. So he cashes in some silver dollars, gets the Federal Reserve notes, and pays the $3,000 tax. Now he's got a little tax he's got to pay to the state and a little tax he's got to pay to the feds. Now, it's well documented. Now, if the government is dissatisfied with this tax return, they need to flag it and say, hey, wait a minute, you got $120,000 in income, not $12,000. Ben's going to say, well, it's true. I contracted for $120,000, but I only got paid $12,000. And since I only got paid $12,000, that's all the tax I'm going to pay. Now, we could try it another way. Suppose that you contracted for $120,000, but your customers didn't pay you. Then they only paid you $12,000. How much tax do you owe? You don't owe the tax on what you contracted for. You owe the tax on what you received. It's what you collected. And that's what Ben did. Now, just like we talked about in the last program, when Judge Holstein and Prosecutor Jacobs set the dates, and then we took that up to the Supreme Court, got the same thing here. When the Supreme Court gets this, assuming that you prosecute me, in the case of Holstein and Jacobs, once the decision came back, hey, give this guy's day in court, they said, we don't want to go there from here. And that's what we have with the IRS and Bill Von Tagen, the State Tax Commission. They looked at Ben's return and they said, hey, we don't want to go there from here. We don't want to know the answer to this riddle. Now, there was a fellow by the name of Aaron Russo. He wrote did a movie. And in this movie, he said, where's the law in Title 26 that requires us to file a tax return? The law is in Title 42, Section 301 through 335. He didn't know that. But in the movie, he went into the commissioner, former commissioner of the IRS, and he said, where is this law? That commissioner, he talked like a Dutch uncle and never answered the question. It's not because the commissioner didn't know the answer to the riddle, but he's sure as hell not going to tell all of you slaves out there. He's not going to tell you that the connecting link is in this oath that you take. Just like in the Army, you know, the military, it's in Title 8, is what you want to know. What makes you a soldier? Title 8 explains that to you. But nobody is going to tell you that it's your oath that makes you a soldier. Because if you knew that, then common sense would say, well, I don't want to go in the military, so I'm not going to take the oath. If you want to test it, you know, when they go to draft you or something like that, just refuse to take the oath, and they're not going to take you in the Army. You can't be a soldier without the oath. You can't be a taxpayer without a taxpayer ID number, and Social Security is your taxpayer ID number. So that's the name of the game, and that was the story that came out of the Ben Rice case. Again, it's what we would say is anecdotal evidence. Well, anecdotal evidence doesn't mean that it isn't evidence and doesn't mean it doesn't prove my point. It just means that we don't have a case out of the Supreme Court that tells us in spades that that's the answer. But when we put out the sting tells us the answer. Well, I'm out of time again here, boys and girls. We'll have to leave it right there and remind you that you've been listening to The Law Hour and Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website, georgegordon.org. Now, The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desk, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has a radio log schedule and archives. All of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. Hey, we'll see you back tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.